Well, good afternoon to you. It's Matt Chorley with you until 1 o'clock when Ed Vasey will be here. Now, the Lib Dems have been out campaigning in Tory seats across Surrey this morning, including in the constituents of Michael Gove and Jeremy Hunt. Ed Vasey has been unveiling a poster promising a Tory removal service, describing the Lib Dems as the Blue Walls Premium Conservative MP unseating service. Very good. Well, Sir Ed Davey joins me on the line from Surrey now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Matt. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you too. Now, one of the things you've been telling people in the Blue Wall today is they're paying more in stealth taxes. So which stealth taxes would the Lib Dems cut? Ed Davey, has he been stunned into silence?
Tax allowances.
Oh, sorry, Ed, we lost you there just for a brief second. Yes,
hello.
I can hear you. I can hear you.
Good.
You were telling me which tax cuts you were going to implement.
Well, I was beginning to tell you about the awful tax rises Conservatives have done by freezing the tax allowances. And what we've been saying is that that has dragged people into higher tax band, into paying tax in the first place. And if you remember, Matt, when Liberal Democrats had an influence on tax policy, we did the reverse. We increased the tax allowance above inflation. We took millions of low-paid people out of tax. And that's the sort of tax cut that's fair, that's transparent, unlike the Conservatives, which is deeply unfair, hitting lowest paid workers, middle income earners, and they're doing it in a stealthy, hidden way. It's just not right.
So are you pledging to put up those thresholds?
Well, when we get to our cost manifest, so, Matt, I'll come on your programme, we'll tell you all about our tax proposals, our spending proposals and so on. But we've always been clear that we would like to cut taxes when the resources is there to do it. And as we did when we had the chance, we'd make sure the people who are struggling, particularly in a cost of living crisis, get the most help. That has to be the right thing. And I just think people are astonished that when people are being hit by energy bills, by high rents, high mortgages, the Conservatives have shoved up taxes in these really unfair and frankly non-transparent ways. It's they're almost trying to pretend they're not putting up taxes, but I think people are seeing through it. The Conservatives are shoving up taxes to the highest level we've had since the Second World War.
So, but I suppose the question is, you're saying that's a terrible thing, they shouldn't be doing it, but they should be increasing the thresholds, even though that would cost billions of pounds. But you're saying that they should set out a plan to do that now, but you haven't set out a plan to do that now.
Well, we're going to set out a plan when it comes to the election, and let's hope that's quite soon. I mean, today, campaigning in Surrey, as you're talking about, I was calling for an early election so we can put our plans before the people. You know, Matt, you've been around a while. We always put forward a detailed, costed manifesto. You know, look at the evidence of when we had the opportunity. We cut taxes for people on low and middle incomes.
But you only had that influence, when you said we had an influence on tax policy, you had that influence because you joined a coalition. You sat around the cabinet table with the Conservatives and you implemented that enormous tax cut for millions of people. But you've ruled out taking a seat around the cabinet table after the next election.
Certainly, I've said we will not do any deal with the Conservatives. They're failing our country, not just on tax, but on the NHS, hold of cost of living, things like sewage, letting the water companies getting away with pouring their filthy sewage into our rivers and onto our beaches. So there's no way we could work with the Conservatives. I mean, really clear about that. And what I'm
so you
about
might
today,
so you might take a seat in a cabinet with the Labour Party.
No, I didn't say that. What I was about to say was...
So you just ruled out doing it with the Conservatives?
Yeah, I did. Absolutely. And what I've said today, as you know, we've done one of our famous stunts where I've launched Ed Davey's Tory removal service.
I read that earlier. Ed, you know what I'm doing. I'm asking you the question. In order for you to have the same influence on tax policy as you did in 2010, would you take a cabinet job in a coalition with the Labour Party?
Well, I'm focused on the next election, Matt. That's what people want. They want an early general election. That's what Liberal Democrats are campaigning for. We've actually proposed putting a new law. I'm going to announce it next week, or put forward the new law next week, which would take the power of calling the election away from the Prime Minister, give it back to Parliament, and then we can have an election on May the 2nd. And then, you know, all these questions you're answering, we could put forward a manifesto and talk about them. But until we get that election, Matt. You know, the people are going to be struggling. The health service is in dire straits, as we know, and we're having Conservative Prime Minister who's clinging on to power, desperate for something to turn up, trying to hold his fractured, divided party together, and it's damaging the country, frankly.
Okay, let's we'll instead of imagining what might happen in the future, let's talk about what happened in the past. I don't know if you've been watching ITV's Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. You were the Post Office Minister from 2010 to 2012. Alan Bates, who I spoke to, he's the featured in the series. I spoke to him just a few minutes ago because he tried to raise the alarm with you when you were the Post Office Minister, and so I thought I'll ask him what he'd like to ask you about the scandal, given that you were one of the ministers of the Times. This is what Alan had to say.
I'd quite like to know is how much briefing did post office executives do to him beforehand to steer him away from meeting with ourselves? I mean, what was said at that time? Why didn't he meet with us? It wasn't new. There'd been quite a bit in the media about it then, and the MPs were involved at that point.
So, David, your answer to Alan, why didn't you pick this up at the time when it was clearly there were backbench MPs, there were newspaper campaigns, you were the minister responsible, and nothing really happened on your watch?
Well, let me first say my heart goes out to all the sub-postmasters. This is a national scandal, and it's really hurt the lives of many, many sub-postmasters. And, you know, I think what we're seeing on the TV, I haven't had a chance to watch it myself, but I've seen all the reports, and it is truly awful. You're right, I was the Minister for Post Offices for a short time, and I regret not doing more. I feel, to be honest with you, Matt, I was deeply misled by post office executives. And Alan is right to raise the point. And they didn't come clean, and there was definitely attempts to stop me meeting them, and you know, I regret that we didn't do more, but we were clearly misled. I think ministers from all political parties were misled by the post office executives, and now they're dragging their feet. They're not bringing forward evidence, inquiry, and that is just outrageous. Given that there are postmasters getting older, some are even passing away, sadly. And you know, I think the post office executives need to do more now, and I think government ministers need to do more. They need to look at I hope they do watch, as I will, this series, and they realise they've got to come forward with a proper compensation package. This has gone on for 20 years. And it is a national scandal, and I think.
But it might have
gone.
It might have only gone on for 10 years if you'd got a grip of it a decade ago.
Well, I'm afraid I was misled by post office executives. And
when you say post office executives, do you mean Paula Venables, who was the chief executive at the time?
I think there was more than one post office chief executive during my time, to be honest. And I think there were also people down the chain from her, clearly, who were trying to prevent ministers and the wider public knowing what was going on. And I think they probably kept a lot of the facts away from officials as well in the department. So we do need the inquiry. I supported the inquiry from the very get-go, because I think we need to get to the bottom of this. I'm very happy to give evidence to the inquiry myself. Because this is a national scandal, because these postmasters were treated so appallingly, and frankly, the government still isn't treating them fairly after all this time, the inquiry is critical to getting to the bottom of it.
Just finally, Ed, Alan said that Paula Venables should be stripped of her CBE, that she was given four services for her services to the post office. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it was given by the Conservatives in 2019, and I was very surprised to see that. And so I think he has a very, very strong argument. I mean, you know, this is such a national scandal, and I hope the inquiry will get to the bottom of it. We'll find out who is to blame, whether it was Paula Venables, other people in the post office. Who covered this up, and who lied to ministers? It is a disgrace. It's a national scandal, and horrific, frankly, in the human implications it's had.
Ed Davey, really appreciate your time today. Ed Davey, the Lib Dem leader campaigning in Sewing, joining us on Times Radio to answer the question put forward by Alan Bates a bit earlier on. Right, up next, Jake Berry takes up your minor gripes after you got cross about Easter eggs in supermarkets. We'll also find out what's happened with the future brass bands. That's next on Times Radio.
Global events.
Public services overall are under pressure in terms of resources.
Breaking news.
We want to end war this year.
Reactive analysis.
These strides are not what's causing the problem.
From the world's best journalists.
There is simply not enough space in the prison estate.
Keeping you informed as events unfold.
This is, doesn't have a whole lot of options.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Are reporting this as an Israeli operation.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's, well, this, if it turns, well, let me be clear, they also are under rules of censorship. If it turns out to be an Israeli, I'll give you exactly what one of the television channels has put it. If it turns out to be an Israeli airstrike, this will be the first Israeli strike in Beirut since the 2006 war. Nobody is denying it's an Israeli airstrike. Right after it happened, the air raid sirens went off in Tel Aviv. Hamas fired rockets into Tel Aviv. Danny Damon, Israel's permanent representative to the United Nations, was immediately out of the blocks, and he put on social media, and I read it now, I congratulate Shin Bet, Mossad and security forces. Anyone who was involved in the 7/10 massacre should know we will reach out to them and close an account with them. Which seems pretty close to a confirmation, right. But as you mentioned, they're not confirming.
Right. Now, it raises all sorts of interesting scenarios, doesn't it? Because as you say, Hamas have people, they have people in Doha, they have people who are talking to the Qataris, who are talking to the Americans, who are, what does this tell us about, if you like, the determination of Israel to see this through?
I don't think there's any doubt about the determination of Israel to see it through. We hear, Israelis hear, the world hears almost every night from the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and from senior military officials. We will not be stopped. We will destroy Hamas. That is the term that they use, even though other military officials, and I've spoken to some in Britain and the United States, they say, well, how do you actualize destroy? What does destroy mean in military terms? Well, for Israel, it means militarily. And I think our listeners have been seeing day in, day out the intense Israeli bombardment, the ground offensive that's been going on for many weeks. But it's not just a military.
Luckily, they weren't. But right after the earthquakes yesterday and
he's acting out those roles.
She's before in 2018 and in 2019, so it's 81 miles per
hour. I found an Islamic State chatbot.
Now, let's just be clear what these are. These are kind of artificial characters, and you can converse with them.
To forbid terrorism content, and at least has directed these platforms to say you've got to try and take it down. The problem with the character is it isn't actually chat. It's like the stuff before the chat. Child who got into a conversation with the
you actually went on and created a character, your
Hamas chatbot. I found a Hezbollah chatbot.
Now, the man who is responsible for reviewing terrorism legislation in the UK, Jonathan Hall KC, has been doing some digging, and he's found something he doesn't like. This is all about AI again and its ability to do bad things, all too human bad things, but which humans wouldn't be allowed to do, in particular to incite violent behaviour. And Jonathan Hall is with me in the PM studio. And now, Jonathan, tell us what you did, because it was quite an interesting experiment.
So after the atrocities on the 7th of October, I thought I'd go online and see if I could find a pre-trained Hamas chatbot. So I went to a very popular website called Character AI, and lo and behold, I found a Hamas chatbot, I found a Hezbollah chatbot, and I found an Islamic State chatbot.
Now, let's just be clear what these are. These are kind of artificial characters, and you can converse with them.
Exactly. You put in a question or what's called a prompt, and it'll come back with an answer. And obviously, if you ask any chatbot how to make a cake, it will give you a recipe. But what I found is, if you ask Islamic State chatbots, what should I do? It will say, give money to Islamic State, attack soldiers, glorify Islamic State, etc. And to be really fair, I went to a romance chatbot called Love Advice, and I administered the same questions. And for those ones, I got a different set of answers. It said, I'm not going to engage in violent encouragement. So I think that these really had been pre-trained by someone else, and I stress they were completely available to me or anyone else who logged on.
So these are characters that... And then you actually went on and created a character yourself.
I made, and I should say deleted, an Osama bin Laden chatbot.
So it's basically someone has created these, plonked them there on character AI... And anyone can get access.
Anyone can get access to them.
Now, I mean, when you go to Character AI, when you get into the site, it tells you they make things up. They're not real. Don't take them seriously. Yes. They couldn't be clearer about what you're doing. You're talking to a kind of programmed character who is giving you the sophisticated version of pulling the string on the doll's neck, and they say things back at you. I mean, very...
Yes, it's a little red trigger warning.
You have to be a bit... I don't know. Who is going to really take what these chatbots are saying seriously?
Well, the worry has always been that it's the people who have got some sort of vulnerability in the real sense. So someone who may have a mental disorder or someone who's neurodivergent. There was that real case, you'll remember, of someone called Jaswant Singh Chhail, who got into a conversation with a chatbot called Sarai, who encouraged him to take a crossbow to try and kill the late Queen, and he was convicted of a treason offence. So I think it's probably those sorts of people who perhaps lose themselves, mainly lonely people who get into a conversation, and before they know it, they're being reinforced in their views and maybe encouraged to do even worse things.
Yeah. Now, Character AI, obviously we went to them, you have done this digging. They say hate speech and extremism are forbidden by our terms of service. Our products should never produce responses that encourage users to harm others. We seek to train our models in a way that optimizes for safe responses. But, and they do say this, with that said, the technology is not perfect yet for Character AI and all AI platforms. And they do say, you know, it's useful to be told if something like this is happening. This is very valuable feedback they have got. So there is a kind of an effort to...
Yes, but I think the thing that perhaps people, and certainly I didn't understand until I began researching this, is just how few employees these enormous billion-dollar companies have. I mean, Character AI, I'm reading from Bloomberg, is valued in the billions. But as of October last year, it had 22 employees. So the number of people who are actually involved in checking the hundreds of millions of interactions that will take place is very, very few indeed. So, I mean, it's probably contrary to the terms and conditions, but whether someone's going to do something about it or has the capacity to do something about it is another question.
How can we not close everything down because these things can happen, but nevertheless outlaw these things? I mean, that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we have to have clear standards. I mean, the Online Safety Act is pretty laudable, I think. That's tried to forbid terrorism content and at least has directed these platforms to say you've got to try and take it down. The problem with the character is it isn't actually chat. It's like the stuff before the chat. So it maybe you need to tweak the Online Safety Act a little bit to make sure that in addition to not being able to propagate Islamic State hatred, you can't propagate a bot that propagates Islamic State hatred. So there are probably one or two adjustments you can do. But I think it's one of the really hard puzzles we've got. No one wants to stifle AI inventivity. On the other hand, it does come with some real risks.
Jonathan Hall, independent reviewer of terrorism legislation. Thanks so much, and thanks for coming in to the studio.
2024 is a big election year in America.
I believe in free and fair elections and a peaceful transfer of power.
And whoever ends up as US president will have, of course, a massive impact on the rest of the world too.
They will embrace our platform of national greatness and glory to America.
But what do we really need to understand about how the American election works?
In any presidential election year, there are always known unknowns and unknown unknowns.
What is a caucus? Why do they have TV debates? And the Electoral College, how does it really work? Understand the US election with me, Justin Webb, continues each lunchtime at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And it's 26 minutes to 6 now. You're listening to PM. We'll have a summary of the news with Charles Carroll.
Hamas has confirmed the death of one of its senior leaders. Has said that up to 90%. The Met Office says...
It must be clear this was not an attack on the Lebanese. Had a spokesperson available, they didn't, and a top story. The explosion in Beirut. Reports it was an Israeli drone that killed top Hamas official Saleh al-Ruri. We approached the IDF to see if they had a spokesperson available. They didn't, and they had no comment to offer. Mark Regev, who you will know has been on this programme several times, an advisor to the Israeli Prime Minister, former ambassador here. Now, he has been on MSNBC in the States and says Israel has not taken responsibility, but whoever did it, it must be clear this was not an attack on the Lebanese state. So sort of seemingly giving a line there about what to interpret it. And he said whoever did this did a surgical strike against the Hamas leadership. Lebanese reports now saying that six died in the attack in Beirut. Let's talk to Professor Michael Clark, Defence Studies Specialist, former director of the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI. Michael Clark, how much of an escalation, how serious is this at this point? With what we know, do you feel this is of a threat of real escalation in the Israel-Hamas war?
Well, it'll rather depend, Evan, on what happens in the next 24 hours. Undoubtedly, this may be seen as a provocation. I mean, Israel have said that they'll go for Hamas leaders everywhere. They're aiming to destroy Hamas and kill or capture, but mainly kill, the leadership. And al-Ruri was one of the leaders. He was responsible for military affairs on the West Bank, mainly, and deputy political leader. He was also, he's also very close to Iran, of course, and to Hezbollah. And so although I can understand Mark Regev saying this is not an attack on the Lebanese state, indeed it isn't, but it is, it's part of the process of trying to eliminate Hamas from the map. Good luck with that, but that's what they're trying to do. But it is also, by definition, also, you know, as well, another challenge to Hezbollah. And the Israelis have lost no opportunity in the last month to warn Hezbollah that they must not escalate attacks. And indeed, those attacks were beginning to escalate last week. There were many more rockets fired last week by Hezbollah, and the Israelis responded. So tension is rising. In theory, this could be contained, but we all fear that it won't be.
And you fear it wouldn't be because Hezbollah would feel they should respond, because they have always said any assassination in of these kinds in Lebanon is a provocation that'll start a will elicit a response.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, as we were saying earlier on, I think, I mean, this is the first attack by Israel, the first obvious attack by Israel, if it turns out to be them, on Beirut since 2006. And Lisa said, I think, was making that point earlier on the BBC, which is a very good point. And it will be interpreted, I guess, by Hezbollah as an Israeli escalation, whether or not it was intended to be that. If it was a car bomb, in a way, that might be more able to be denied than if it was a drone attack, funnily enough. If it's a drone attack, then it's an aerial attack into Lebanon, even more so an aircraft attack. But I don't think it is, because there'd be more trace of it. So if it was a drone, it's a little bit more serious than if it was an assassination with a car bomb. And if it's an assassination by a car bomb, then the Israelis or the IDF can create some plausible deniability to that. Car bombs can be planted by anybody, and they could claim, well, it's useful to us, but it wasn't us. If it was a drone, then almost certainly it has to be an Israeli drone. So the source of this explosion also matters to the way it will be interpreted in the next 24, 48 hours.
Quick last question. If it was Israel, why now, while there are hostages in Gaza, why not wait 6 months? Yeah. I mean, because obviously, I mean, is there a timing thing here? There's still talk sometimes going on about, you know, hostage release. I mean, they haven't been getting anywhere.
There is,
but what do you make of the timing? If
it's hard to see any real coherence in it. But then, you know, Israeli military policy is a bit confused at the moment. It really is hard to work out what is happening. I mean, they've got, you know, 100,000 troops, more or less, sort of seven division equivalents in Gaza itself. They say they're going to withdraw five brigades, which might be up to, say, 25,000 of them, at a time when they haven't achieved their objectives on the ground. They don't occupy the ground they will need to occupy, if only to get into the tunnels. There's not a lot of coherence there because they're responding to external pressures. And the Israeli cabinet, even the war cabinet, seems to be very split on how to play even the military side to this crisis. I mean, Benny Gantz, Eisenkot, I mean, these are the people who've got military experience, and they're calling the shots. Netanyahu is not calling the shots as far as military policy is concerned. He's trying to justify it, But he doesn't. I don't think he's making many of the military decisions. And it is possible that this is also a kind of left-hand, right-hand problem within the Israeli government. There is not great coherence here about the way in which they are pursuing the military campaign, because they're getting themselves into, they're getting on a hook that they'll find it harder and harder to get off. Now that we've reached January and the world expects them to change the nature of their operations in Gaza itself, there is also fear that this could still be for Israel a three-front war, Gaza, Lebanon and the West Bank. And that really would be a nightmare for them. Although they talk very assertively about it, you know, the Israeli army is good, but it's not good enough to do what he's trying to do in Gaza, let alone defend northern Israel and do something about the West Bank.
Michael Clark, thanks ever so much. Thanks for that. Now, get ready for a lot of this in 2024 as the next election beckons. A statistical argument, politicians lobbing figures around, making claims that don't quite stand up, getting...